Hello and welcome to Agents of Nonprofit. My name is Alexander Lapa, and I'm here to speak with everyday superheroes helping nonprofits. Joining me today is Jenny Mitchell to talk about mindset. Jenny, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So to kick off today's episode, I'd love to know your superhero origin story.
Oh boy, love the superhero analogy. That's just such a great way to think about the work we do in nonprofits. I'd say that my superhero skill is helping people have meaningful conversations. And I don't know where I learned it, Alex, although I would probably trace it back to when I was a kid, always being the person in the playground, being able to figure out what was really going on and being able to hold space for other people, for their conversations, for their emotions, for their connections. And I've brought that skill through a varied career, through music. I was a classical musician for many years, where, of course, meaningful conversations happen through instruments, not through words, to becoming, of course, a consultant in the fundraising world, and now as an executive coach. And that superpower shows up when I work with boards. It shows up when I work with clients. And I hope it shows up in this podcast.
So you're the kind of person that I admire, because I'm wise enough and aware enough to know that I don't know what's going on, but I'm also wise enough and aware enough to know to look to people who do know what's going on. So in a crowded room, for example, I'm able to pick up the people who seem to see more than and hear more than that I see and hear. So yeah, that's awesome. That's a great skill. It's not easy to cultivate, but it can be used for a lot of great good.
Well, and I think it's learnable. As I've done more training and coaching and teaching, I've realized that there's some pieces that we can learn and incorporate into our daily lives. And so I just want your listeners to leave with this idea that, you know, having meaningful conversations starts with looking for them. There's actually opportunities every day for them with the male person, with your kids, with your bosses. But so often we're focused on the next thing, the next action, the next to-do. We ramrod over that magical moment. And so I hope that's helpful for your listeners.
That's it. Perfect. That's a wrap. We got it. We don't need to go any further. No, I'm kidding, of course. That's just the beginning.
Of course. Yeah.
I totally agree. No, it's a good summary, but it's obviously just the beginning. And I agree. I think there's so many people that wait for a moment, a pause, to be able to just respond to something they've already built up in their minds, and they've stopped actively listening to the people that they're talking to.
100%. And that's that idea of listening to understand versus listening to respond. And I've certainly been guilty of listening to respond as well, but I'm working hard on the former.
I imagine, because the topic for today is more about mindset than listening, but I imagine that two are closely related. And I was hoping you could start by then talking about or defining what do we mean by mindset? And especially in particular, the ambitious mindset, because I think that's the more productive one, and we can add other versions of mindsets as well.
For sure. Absolutely. So the word ambition has been something that I have been throwing around in my head and in my communities for a long time, because as a woman, and not just as a woman, but even when you think about a board, is it okay for a board to be ambitious? Is there any downside to being ambitious? And how does that tie to mindset? And here's what I've noticed in my many years working as a consultant and as a coach. People are people, first of all, and people come to the table with different philosophies and approaches and core beliefs. And I started taking a look at what are the mindsets that people bring that are most helpful to fund development, you know, our world that we love to live in, Alex. And what are the mindsets that are really detrimental to fund development? And what I experienced was sort of themes. Basically, if a board comes to me to train and says, I want to get better at X, and we'd love your help to do it, by definition of seeking out help, they have a positive or an ambitious mindset to accomplish something together. It doesn't mean there isn't going to be obstacles, but they're focused on a possibility. Similarly, when there is a scarcity mindset in the organization, and by the way, it's palpable, you can smell it, they're pinching every penny, they really don't know where their next donation is going to come from, that scarcity mindset starts to seep into their thinking. They start to think small. And so mindset really is the collection of beliefs that you hold to be true as a person and as a leader. And that mindset is your single biggest asset when you are going out to change the world with our missions. And so I started focusing in on how I could support people to shift mindsets for success. And you know, the old Dale Carnegie book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, that's basically a book about mindset as well. This idea that if you believe you can or you believe you can't, you are correct. Mm-hmm. And how you cultivate that intentional mindset for possibility is part of the process of becoming a leader. It's part of the process of becoming a great fundraiser and helping people uncover, because everybody has it, that mindset in themselves is something I'm very excited about and very committed to doing.
Uncovering a mindset, that's an interesting point, because I have sometimes felt that certain people don't want to have a mindset, or they're resistant to it, or they are just so sure of the way that they think that they don't know of any other way to think. And changing mindset is a huge game-changing type of approach to things. And I guess my question would then be, is it a matter of uncovering a certain mindset, of peeling back certain layers and saying, okay, here it is, you just had it covered by so many layers of historical experiences or bad, Or is it something more, how do we cultivate? I guess the question is, how do we cultivate an idea that a mindset is something that we can change and that we should change if we have the wrong, unproductive or unhelpful one?
Yeah, I think that's a better word, unproductive, because there's no rights or wrongs really when it comes to human behavior, right? It just is. I really like your onion analogy. So I have this I want to go all coachy and neuroscience for you for a second. We know that the brain is incredibly neuroplastic, and the neuroplasticity of the brain continues throughout your whole life. So yes, when you're younger, your brain is better at absorbing and shifting and changing, but it does not stop, Alex. We have the capacity right up into our 80s and 90s to keep growing and changing our neurons. And so what happens with these mindsets is, based on our conditioning, based on the way we're raised, based on the stories we hold to be true, you know, the narrative about ourselves, we will look in our world for validation of those truths. And so if you're an organization that's always been scarce with money, or, you know, how often do I hear, well, I could raise more money if I had cute puppies or babies, right? Well, that may or may not be true, right? But it's these external factors. So finding and cultivating opportunities for, rather than fixed mindset, growth mindset. Fixed mindset is, and this is the work of Carol Dweck, who wrote a seminal research about this. Fixed mindset is, well, I'm born, I have a certain level of intelligence, and that's just the way it's going to be. Versus a growth mindset is, where are my opportunities for change? Who do I want to be when I grow up? And how can I make that happen internally? And we know that people with a growth mindset can continue to adapt and grow every day, every week. With the invention of artificial intelligence and all that's coming down the pipeline, I think that ability to adapt is going to become even more important. But the way I like to think about it, just to go back to your original question, we are all born with all the skills we need in this world. That's just something that I fundamentally believe, and something that the research also supports. We all have different experiences that shape us, but reminding ourselves that we have sovereignty, we have choice over what we think and what we believe, and how we show up in the world, is a fundamental element to being human on this planet. And the more you can tap into your own choices and knowledge and empowerment, the more successful you'll be, but also the happier you'll be. Yes, you will meet people that are stuck in their stories, and I feel for them. I still believe they're capable of change. They just may not be capable of change for the needs that I have as a professional fundraiser, or as a business coach, or as an author.
My mom is a collector of comics, like the original comics. She contacts actually the authors of these comics and they sometimes center the initial prince. And one of them, I don't remember the author's name, but it's Hagar the Horrible, which is going back a few years now. And his minion asked Hagar, you know, where is the key to happiness? What is the key to happiness? And Hagar very insightfully says, it's inside me, meaning mm-hmm. I have everything I need inside me. And of course, the comic concludes by the minion saying, what? You swallowed the key to happiness? As if it was a physical key. But the idea of the idea that we have everything that we need inside us already, that we don't need something externally to make us who we are mm-hmm. or better or everything that we want to achieve, that we can do it, was something that mm-hmm. for me took a long time to discover and realize and then depend upon. But I find I have no idea how I would be able to invoke something like that, that kind of thought process in someone else. Do you have any clues to that? Mm-hmm.
Well, that really is what coaching's about, right? It's about creating. So let's flip it out of coaching. That's what I do professionally. But let's talk about friends, right? Let's talk about colleagues. I find that speaking back to meaningful conversations, I work really hard and I intentionally ask a lot of open-ended questions, Alexander. Oh, interesting. What is it about that that makes that true for you, right? Or someone who won't give up their story about a spouse who doesn't understand them or whatever. I find that, you know, one of the coaching roles is to mirror back to somebody their experience. So, you know, a girlfriend will say, oh, I don't like my job, but I'm stuck because I make so much money here that I couldn't possibly switch jobs. And I'll often ask questions like, oh, interesting. What is it that you know about this? Or have you had this happen in real life? And often they'll say, oh, no, I just know this, right? So asking, there's a phrase called, you know, asking for proof positive. Is it true? And what proof do you have of whether it's true? And those are some of the things you can ask as a friend. And then how could you redirect that truth to some other conclusion? Those are kind of some examples of the way we reframe or mirror back situations to people to allow them to be in charge of their choices. Coaching is not about fixing people. Just wanted to say that out loud.
I've heard of mirroring. I've heard of mirroring though in the context of connecting with someone, in that if you mirror their gestures, they're more likely to find you interesting and similar because you have similar gestures and similar manners. I've never heard it in terms of reframing a conversation. And you think, or you're telling me that this is one way to help someone start changing their mindset to question, I guess, their own biases, right?
You betcha. Exactly. We also use this in negotiation techniques. This is what's really interesting is mm-hmm. often in negotiation, you'll take the last three words of somebody's statement. So if someone says, well, I couldn't possibly do that because we have a deadline of Monday. And the response from a negotiation perspective is a deadline of Monday, to which the person immediately continues on, Alex, and explains more. So it's the same phrase as tell me more. That is another phrase we can use a lot. Because what we do as humans, I think, is we have this brain running that makes quick assumptions to keep us safe. Let's remember that safety is our number one goal for our brain. Sometimes it keeps us safe from things that aren't real, by the way. and safety, it's trying to quickly extrapolate. So taking the time to explore what's underneath the words, taking the time to allow someone to extrapolate and come to their own conclusions or clarify for themselves what they're either experiencing or what they're feeling, that's actually a beautiful gift to give a friend or a colleague. You're not always going to be able to change people's minds. Our world right now is particularly polarized, and I'm very sad about that, but I know that dialogue, discussion, and conversation and holding space is one of the ways we can continue to meet each other as humans rather than as stereotypes. And I think that is the biggest risk for, I not even not-for-profit, I see the planet, speaking of meaningful conversations.
I imagine you've also read the book by Chris Voss, the negotiation guy, the FBI negotiation guy.
Oh my God, repeat it again, because your listeners need to hear the name of this book.
Yeah, now I'm going to Google it at the same time because I want to make sure I don't misspeak it. But it's Chris Voss, and it's a former FBI negotiator who wrote a book, and it's brilliant about negotiation and that repeating the three words and the mirroring is are both in there among many other strategies.
Yeah. I'll pick up one other thing that he talks about that it's a brilliant book. He talks about the black swan. And the analogy he makes is that in every conversation or every negotiation, there's some kind of a black swan that on the surface does not exist. And if you spend the time, and again, this really relates to major gifts. This relates to working with your employees and your staff. If you spend the time to listen and understand, there's always a black swan, a deal breaker, a core belief, an action item, a negotiable that drives behavior. And the person that you're negotiating with may not even know about it. That's the part I find really cool. So listening for the black swans, how about that?
So the book is called Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. Brilliant book. Right. Let's go, because I love these Venn diagrams of mindset and negotiation. Mm-hmm. And in terms of mindsets, and I know this is going to sound like an obvious question, but why is it so important to have an abundant mindset? What can you accomplish when you have the right mindset?
I love that you put the word abundant in front of it. So I think, I like to infuse science with what we know and feel as humans. And I think so often, especially as smart people, we rely so much on our heads, Alex, and our brains. So I like to kind of incorporate both. So let's start with the neurology. The neuropathic patterns in our brain helping us imagine that there is a potential future out there that is not yet achieved or not yet available to us. That is believing in something that you can't actually see. So we're actually talking about faith, whatever you want to call faith in your world. We're talking about seeing possibilities in the world. How do you cultivate that? You remind yourself that there's so much that you don't know. I often talk about this with capital campaigns. I'll say, you know, how many of you in the room believe there's enough money out there to fund all of the missions in the world? And the people that put their hands up are the people I want to work with, because the ones that don't think there's enough money will not find the money. That's just the way the universe operates. The universe rewards you. And I know this sounds woo-woo, but it's based in science and fact. The universe will help you see what you're looking for. So if you're pregnant, all of a sudden you see all these pregnant ladies around because you never noticed them before because they weren't on your radar. And this is the way the brain works. This is neuroscience. So that's on the thinking side. On the emotional and the body side, basically scarcity and abundance tie to fear and love. Okay. So when you're in fear mindset, when you are worried you're not going to make budget, when you're worried not enough people are going to come to the event, when you're worried you're not a good enough fundraiser or a good enough board member, insert the blank, right? Podcaster, whatever it is, your body will seek to replicate that in itself. So you will find your shoulders dropping, you will find that your heart rate goes up, and all of these activities in the body affect the brain. They lower the amount of blood going to your brain, therefore you can't come up with good solutions. The research coming out around trauma, which affects safety and feeling safe as a person, the kind of impact that trauma has on our bodies, we're only starting to kind of unpeel this. But that scarcity and fear has real effects. And we're talking intergenerational here. I'm going multi-year trauma into there, and which is why there's so much work being done in this section, but also we have a lot of work to undo. The beautiful part about it is, it's great to have a therapist. It's great to have an executive coach to help you through those or to notice things for you. But this is work that you can do for yourself. Everything that you've experienced doesn't have to be part of your story going forward. The things that have happened to you, and this ties back to ambition, don't have to define you unless you choose to have them define you. So all of you listening out here, your narrative is yours to create going forward. And so often that shift from scarcity to abundance starts with setting an intention to see abundance and see possibility. And you would be amazed how the world changes in front of you. There's many thoughts in there. I'm curious which ones jump out for you, Alex, on that, my description there.
Yeah, I'm scrambling to take notes here because I'm loving it. So I have seen it in my own life, not personally, but my partner. She's been taking a lot of coaches, that is to say sessions with coaches about mindsets. And it is amazing to be firsthand witness to the transformation that's happening in her life. Just like you, I think I said, setting the intention of saying, this is going to happen. I believe it. Even if you truly believing that something is going to happen, will more likely make it happen. And it does, to your point, sound woo-woo. We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah.
But it's the first step. And it's not the last step. It's not like you can say, this is going to happen. You cross your fingers. You know, do your dance, your happy dance, and you expect it to happen. There is, of course, work to be done. But there is a stage, there's a stages to go through. And the first stage is allowing yourself to realize it's physically possible to happen. And you have to get to that in such a way that you really, as much as you can, I'm not sure 100%, but because I like numbers, but there has to be you have to really believe it. I don't know what that quantifiably means, but you have to really believe that it's possible before you can take the next step. Because otherwise, to your point, you'll doubt yourself in some way. And then what you think is what you
become.
That expression? Well, I think that's it. What you become. There was another version that's slightly different, but it's basically the same thing.
So for those of you that are skeptical listening to this call, I don't want you to think that we're talking about false positivity or of like, you know, I can make this happen if I, what's the word, hypnotize myself. But you are what you think, and you don't have to believe all of your thoughts. And let me give you a perfect example of this. And we're learning so much more about a mental health. We're learning so much more about all these things. You know, anybody who suffers with OCD will be familiar with these intrusive thoughts that come into their world. And they're very interruptive, and they interrupt their flow. I had an amazing launch last week. Alex, my book launched last week in Toronto. We had like, I don't know, 130 people at this amazing launch. We did readings. It was fantastic. Okay. Wow. Like talk about mindset. And it was just so empowering to hear people loving those stories and loving those moments in the room. And I came home on a huge high. And Sunday night, I could feel it starting, right? The mindset kicks in. Well, that was last week. You know, what's going to happen this week? How do you know that's going to translate into sales, right? And the little ego voice that's there, in the past, I would have believed it and I would have started to get dark and I would have started to see the problems. What's different now is because I have done so much of this mindset work, I go, oh, look at that. My brain is here keeping me safe. Look at that. It's taking care of me. It's protecting me. And so I say, thank you so much, you know, to myself, because this is part of me. I say, thank you so much. I appreciate you. But I'm going to keep looking for opportunities here. And that's that scarcity abundance. And that scarcity of, because if I believed that voice, Alex, so that's another thing to say is, if I believed that voice, what would I do? And the answer is, if I believed that the scarcity voice, I'd quickly hop on my computer. I'd start to email people looking for leads. I'd start to drop my prices. I'd start to worry and stress about where the money's going to come from for next month. Like it's a self-perpetuating prophecy. Or if I believed that I had done enough that week and I believed that my work and my work product were solid, I would go to bed at a reasonable hour. I would get up the next morning and I work hard. Like this isn't about not working hard, because I love to work hard. It's about appreciating your efforts. And I just think this is such an important message for not-for-profits. We are in the middle of grappling for this. And the profile of the people that is working in not-for-profits is so distorted. I mean, distorted in a good way towards people who genuinely care deeply about their work. But I want to bring this message that you don't have to physically experience it, the scarcity or the worry, in order to be successful at the work and to help the people you care about.
The second point I picked up on, and this is a bit trickier, is that, and I agree, but it's tricky, is the past doesn't have to dictate your future. And that kind of, that can be very pivotal, but it also can be very challenging to just shed either pains of the past or issues. And just say, you know, as of today, I'm going to be a new person. Right? I think that concept is a very difficult one. Change takes time, but it is possible over a period of time, right? It's not a matter of turning on a light switch and then saying, okay, I am a different person today, as of today or as of this moment. But there are ways that you can train yourself to say, look, this is not an effective thought process. I don't like the scarcity mindset. and make the efforts and do the exercises to be able to, at some point, be able to create that better version of yourself, the one that will have more of that abundant mindset.
I love that. And, you know, on a simple level, one of the questions I ask myself a lot is, if you truly loved yourself, what would you do?
It's a dangerous question.
Simplifies it.
But that's a beautiful question.
Isn't it? It's that simple. If I truly love myself, what time would I go to bed tonight? Right?
Oh, I love that. I'm gonna write that one down.
Is it that simple? Yes, it is. If I truly loved myself, would I stay in this job? If I truly loved myself, would I get a dog? Well, okay, that one has. I don't want to come off on this podcast as insincere or like Buddhist-ish, but I do want to share with you that every time I have made a step towards that, it has served me well. And I have invested over the years in people or surrounding myself with people with those kinds of mindsets or challengers or coaches, business coaches and otherwise, because it's a much faster path. I think everyone will eventually find it on their own, but having people to guide you, having people to challenge you or keep you on the straight and narrow when things start to bubble or bump, or when you start to doubt, is very important in your own personal journey. And you know, you feel it in your sleep, you feel it in your body, you feel it in your areas of focus. You know, it's such a bonus. I mean, it's better than vitamins. It's better than vitamins, Alex.
So let's balance this picture a little bit, because we mentioned woo-woo a couple of times. Yeah. Let's just go for the more skeptical approach. What would you say to people who are saying, like, this is a lot of woo-woo, it's great, but it's all roses and unicorns and it doesn't really apply in the real world? Or, you know, the skeptic, the one that, how would you address their concerns and in a more factual way, or maybe a more grounded way, to say, look, there really is something here. This is not, I mean, you mentioned a science in the brain, which I think is a start.
Yep.
Is there anything more that you can add to it to help convince people at least of the possibility that this is a good option or a good direction to go into?
Yeah, love that. I'm visualizing the treasurers on our boards of directors right now, by the way. You know, that sort of that play that role of factual proof, show me the proof, right? And I won't see it until I believe it. And I think there's a couple things to think about. Number one, I would ask, what do you know to be true, right? Like, what have you experienced with this before? Often when I work with people that have a scarcity mindset or want to hold tight, tight, tight to things, whether it's money, power, control, all those things, what I find is that they are holding on for dear life because it makes them feel safe. And so, again, I will often disarm them with the question of, what's your greatest fear? Maybe they haven't thought about it. What's your greatest fear? Oh, that the charity goes under, oh, that I lose my best assistant, or oh, you know, that I'm going to lose my house because I haven't saved enough money for retirement. So I often will ask that as a disarming question. The other question I'll ask is, how could you experiment with this? So let's go with your scarcity mindset that the market is going to crash next month, right? Because we're always hearing about market crashes. And the market is going to crash. Absolutely, it's going to crash at some point. We just don't know exactly when. So one of the things I will often say is, how could we pilot something different? Could we take $25,000 and put it in something else? What would make us feel safe and yet still stretchy? And often people kind of turn their head and sort of put on their sides for me and go, oh, what do you mean by that? Because they actually can't compute what I'm talking about. If you look at successful people, and you know, successful is a loaded word, so I don't mean to say that, but if you look at capitalism, and again, I guess that's becoming a loaded word, but it is about believing that the consumers will come, that there is continually a need for a new product, that we can continue to generate revenue, which, by the way, isn't just profits for shareholders, but jobs, opportunities, hopefully an improvement in the entire community that we live in, or the country that we live in. I think capitalism has had some major failures along the way in relating to equity, which we are now unpacking. But anybody that you can think of from a successful CEO believed that something was possible. If you look at Steve Jobs, if you look at folks like that, they leaped in before the consumers were ready, maybe even before the funders were ready. Like, it's kind of like having a plan B is not an option. Really committing to a plan A is really scary, but also very motivating. So I guess I'm using my language here and my strategies to help you to help respond to somebody who is scarcity mindseted. That being said, sometimes the best thing to do is to bless and release them out of your life. And what I find is that when you grow and change, not everybody in your community is necessarily going to want to grow and change with you. And that's something you're going to have to accept. And that can be hard.
Yeah, that I totally agree with. Changes can be scary for that reason, because you might lose things that you have today. But the goal is to be in a better place. I wanted to circle back. Actually, it was as you were talking, you talked about scarcity mindset and abundance mindset and fundraising. Mm-hmm. And I noticed one difference with people who have a scarcity mindset is that they believe if one person is donating to another fund, to another charity, for example, that there's less money in the world for them to give to their charity, as opposed to an abundant mindset, which there's enough money to go all around. Just because one organization is getting it doesn't mean we will not get something. It's more like the pie is getting bigger. There's not a piece of pie that everyone has to eat from. And, you know, if someone eats from the pie, then you don't. It's the pie will just get bigger. And having that kind of mindset in terms of being able to really believe that there is more or enough, let's say, for everybody, can help you make better decisions for your organization.
I love that. I love the idea that the pie just gets bigger. For me, it would be pizza, because I'm a pizza person. So think of it this way. So what is a couple, again, I go back to coaching questions, you know, and I work with a lot of young staff, and they'll say, well, they're already giving $5,000 to organization X. Why would they give money to us? And I'll often ask the question, well, what assumptions are you making? Well, that they only have so much to give to charity, that their net wealth, their net assets is finite, that they don't like us. Like, there's a whole bunch. And so often I'll just open up with that. And then I'll say, well, how could we debunk those in a way that would be respectful to both sides? So, you know, in fund development, we talk a lot about permission-based asking. And permission-based asking, just to explain, is I go talk to the $5,000 donor to organization X and say, you know, I wonder, I notice you give to Y or organization X, would you be open to a conversation with me about getting to know more about organization Z? And allowing them permission-based, giving them permission to tell you whether you want to know more or not, whether they want to know more or not. And that's a very simple thing, but it takes away the sort of ego and the success and the failure piece out of it, that all we're doing is creating space for meaningful dialogues. And that whole scarcity thing is, it seeps in, right? And it's self-perpetuating. So then you don't go to that donor that's giving $5,000 somewhere else, and therefore your revenue doesn't go up. And so you keep losing donors, and you keep asking yourself why you're losing donors. And you're so focused on the loss of the donors that you're not actually engaging, because now the fear of engaging is so real and rampant that you can't actually pick up that 100-pound phone anymore. So I think one of the things is catch your assumptions and ask yourself, is that actually true? It may be true, Alex, but until you have proof of it, let's hold reserve judgment until we can find out. I always often will say, let's just find out more information. Let's collect more data points. And as an analyst, that can also be a great way to sort of debunk analytical minds, treasurers and on the boards, is let's just take a look at the data and let's make an assessment from that. That's also been very helpful for me.
I recently had to go through an exercise where I questioned my thoughts, and I realized, and I was taught, that thoughts are just thoughts. They're right. Not facts necessarily. Yeah. And too often, at least for in my case, I would think of something and then say, and take it as fact, just as the sky is blue. And it took me a little while to get used to the fact of saying, listen, hang on a second, this is just a thought. There isn't enough, to your point, there isn't enough data points to actually prove this or disprove this. So let's collect more data before we start jumping to conclusions and saying that this thought is actually true. And I think that ties in nicely with what you're just saying now.
I love that. And you don't have to believe everything you think.
Absolutely.
So we've been conditioned. I took a 12-day trip to France. And a lot of this is about identity, too. If you want to even go bigger around mindset, you know, Jenny saying, I am the kind of person who can take a 12-day trip to France without a computer. You know, 10 years ago, I could not have said that to you. I just couldn't, because that wasn't who I identified. My identity was, I'm a workaholic. You know, my life is my work. My family is number one. I couldn't possibly leave them behind. All that good gobbledygook guilt stuff. And I took the trip the week before the virtual launch of the book, Alex, which was a real leap of faith. But I wanted to do both. And I felt that I was in a good place, believing that the launch was in a good place. And I went for it. And so the other message here is, you don't know unless you try things. And this ties into the fear of failure, where, you know, it could have flopped and that would have been okay. And I still would have woken up the day after the launch and picked myself up and kept going. But I would have gained information and knowledge from it. So I'm also a big proponent of talking publicly about what works, but also what doesn't work, and taking away the blame and shame around. I mean, I'm sure you've had software integrations or with your work that have not gone the way you planned, right? Back me up here, Alex.
For sure. There's always going to be. I actually had an email today about Mr. Murphy, how during a client demo, to anticipate something going wrong, to be prepared for it, to know how to handle it. And that is better off than just expecting and hoping that things will go well.
Yeah. So the how you show up, like if you're going to encapsulate some of the things we're talking about, in my old life, I used to plan and protect and defend and worry and be extremely anxious and sort of, you know, prepare for the worst. Yes, we still need to prepare. But my new approach is, or my alternate approach is, yes, that's important, but actually what's way more important, Alex, and using this podcast as an example, is showing up, being here with you, and listening like mad. That is probably the most important contribution I can make. I could have spent hours prepping for the questions that you so generously provided, but getting comfortable with yourself and knowing not just so much who you are, but what you offer to the world. Going back to that, if you truly loved yourself, what would you do? How would you prepare for this podcast? Has really served me well. And I want people to hear that they are enough, that what they're doing matters and the work they're putting in is enough. And if they want to add that ambitious salt, or if they want to do more, great, please go for it. Try things, learn things, but know that it's overflowing the cup rather than filling the cup. You know, that old analogy of, you know, that your cup, that helping others fills your cup. I think we should have enough that fills everybody's cup. And if you're feeling super great, find a way to help somebody else, because that to me is the energy flow that I'm looking for from my work with my partners and my clients and my coaching folks. And this podcast is a great example. Just, you know, meaningful conversations. Here we are back to that again.
I also love the fact that you address fears directly. You call them out. You don't try to skimp around them. You try to figure out and work with clients, I assume, on, you know, listing what are the worst things that can happen in this situation. And then I guess its next step would be devising a plan to manage with them. But by being very explicit, by going straight for the elephant in the room, I find people, especially when you start looking for more evidence that supports it, a lot of these things tend to fall away, because we have thoughts. These thoughts come up with fears, and then we can start breaking them down and changing your mindset to a more positive one, because it's not supported, or the bad news is not supported by actual evidence. Things are never as bad as you think they're going to be. They're always somewhere, I don't want to say in the middle, but there's always, they're never as bad as you think they're going to be.
Well, things just are. Let's even go like kind of Buddhist on you here. And to remember too, that when the action happens, the thing that happens and your reaction to it, there's this lovely little gap in the middle between when it happens and what you react with. And that is the moment of choice and the moment of opportunity, really, because I mean, I work a lot with leaders. So we talk a lot about emotional intelligence, and we talk a lot about how we have to be, no matter what happens, we have to be in not so much control of our emotions, but we have to be grounded in our emotions because we don't want to say something that we regret. The only way that happens is if your emotions take you away from where you are and they sort of react without thought. And I don't want to do that in my life anymore. I want to be a lot more intentional. And so having that director role of like, 30,000 feet, isn't this interesting what's happening here? What am I feeling? How would I label this? What are my choices here versus that person sucks, or how can I be in control here? Or why is that person so annoying? I mean, truly, this takes a practice. This isn't like something you, but it's as simple as moving from a judger to a learner mindset. The judger says somebody screwed up or it's somebody's fault. The learner says, what are my choices here? And it's picked up in the whole room. The whole room changes when that happens. And it's amazing what kind of outcomes you can come up with together.
It is a bit Buddhist, but I agree that things just are, and it's our interpretation of them that makes it good or bad. And that's a little more Buddhist than I was expecting to go to on this call. But it's totally true. Like it's once you get to a certain level and you start observing yourself and you start noticing things, you know, I find meditation is doing that for me now, is mm-hmm. you become much more mindful of things and you're just watching things. You're not really reacting as quickly. You're taking that brief moment between those two, between the actual incident and your reaction to it, just to take a quick pause. And it's just, if you can be aware even of that one pause, it's already a step in the right direction. But if then you can then spend more time in there, in that little zone, you'd be surprised with what you can accomplish, because all of a sudden your whole perspective of the situation changes. You're no longer, to your point, reacting. You're now, you're seeing it from a different perspective, a more calmer, more less reactive perspective.
And we are a suite of raging hormones and chemicals. So, you know, it's a reality of the world we live in. And I love that way you describe that. For your listeners, I love to give like, where could I start with this? Like this, if this is really feeling like a place you want to explore. And, you know, both of us, Alex, you and I on this call, it is a very, what's the word? I guess I've been looking for calm or contentment in my life for so long. And I know that sounds so cheesy. And it's taken me a long time to get here. Trust me, I've done the work. But you know, there's little things you can do. One small thing you can do is meditation. If you're not a meditator, a little bit of journaling, noticing your thoughts. I remember one time a therapist I worked with said, just label every time all day the emotions you're experiencing, those simple things. Maybe it's a matter of unwinding. I love music. It's what, of course, I'm a classical musician trained, so I will often put on music without words. Very important not to have words, and actually listen to the music as opposed to chopping vegetables for dinner. Finding that space for you to connect with yourself, and it doesn't have to be a ton of time. Often I will take a pause. I'll get caught up. I'm sure you can relate to this, Alex, you're in something that seems really important, right? I'm in some article or, I don't know, answering emails. Somehow email really triggers me. It's like this total dopamine thing. And I'll just stop and I'll just take three big breaths. I mean, is it as simple as that to recalibrate? And this becomes self-perpetuating. You start to, you know, we're learning so much more about the somatic nerve system, and I'm doing more research, and I'm really committed to bringing this kind of experiences to the not-for-profit sector, because we don't need to walk around triggered, hurt. We need strong, confident, comfortable leaders that can hold the weight of the organization, that can support others. And it starts with very simple, very small things like taking a couple breaths.
I imagine listeners will have tons of questions, because I know we just, even in the time we spent together, have just scratched the surface. So I'm hoping you can share with the listeners, dear listener, ways that they can get in touch with you so that you can help them or direct them to toward this beautiful journey.
Oh, thank you, Alex. Thank you very much. So I guess on a simple level, my company is called Chavender. That's Chavender like lavender, but with a CH at the beginning. And you can also find me on LinkedIn. Of course, Jenny Mitchell is a pretty common name, but if you put in Jenny Mitchell Chavender, you might find me there. And I also have a podcast, Alex. So I run a podcast called Underdog Leadership, and that title means a lot to me. It's the idea that we can all help grow in life and work. I definitely include life and work, and I really appreciate that you've made space in this conversation for life and work, because we are humans. We bring our human selves to work. So have a look at that, especially if you're an aspiring leader. And of course, really what I want folks to hear about and what I'm super proud of right now is a book that has just come out this month called Embracing Ambition, Empowering Women to Step Out, Be Seen, and Lead. And it is available on Amazon. And it is 12 first-person stories from women about what it feels like to lead as an executive woman. So those are the ways you can get in touch with me.
Jenny, thank you so much for joining me today in this conversation. And thank you so much for the work that you do.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right, that's it for today. I'm Alexander Lapa, and I hope you join me again in the next Agents of Nonprofit.